This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I have, this is very unusual, three guests today. None of them are in the studio with me. From New York City, I have Ted Thompson, the editor of the book I'm about to tell you about, and writer Jonathan Safran Foer. From a stint at the McDowell Colony, I have Kelly Link, and we're about to talk about a young adult book that the McSweeney's people put out that I feel quite charmed by. And, you know, as soon as you get it, everywhere you look, you find a cover designed by Chip Kidd that can be folded up into an envelope that can be sent in to the McSweeney's folk as an entry in a contest. You find, as you open the book, full-color illustrations and fold-out maps. There's even a crossword puzzle for the kid who has read all the stories will be able to zip through and make a puzzle out of what he's found out. I like a book that displays what I think of as the necessary generosity a book should have toward its readers, especially if it's trying to intrigue young people. When you open the cover, there's even a fantastic photograph of some kind of parade involving blobs and strange creatures who are being looked at from the sidewalk by kind of puzzled adults. It's really nice. Now, the reason I haven't told you the title of the book is because it's so long that most people are not going to say it, and I'm going to make the editor say it for us. What, Ted Thompson, is the title of this book?
The title of the book is Noisy Outlaws, Unfriendly Blobs, and Some Other Things That Aren't As Scary, Maybe, Depending on How You Feel About Lost Lands, Stray Cell Phones, Creatures from the Sky, Parents Who Disappear in Peru, A Man Named Lars Farf, and one other story we couldn't quite finish, so maybe you could help us out.
Now, from now on, this book is going to be referred to as Noisy Outlaws, Unfriendly Blobs, and Some Other Things, just for convenience's sake. Now, you edited it, Ted, along with Eli Horowitz's help for McSweeney's, but can you tell me, what were you looking for? How did these stories come together?
Well, the book was conceived as a charity project first for a free writing center that I work for in Brooklyn, New York, called 826 NYC. And 826 NYC is a chapter of an organization in San Francisco that called 826 Valencia that shares a building with McSweeney's. So when we were opening 826 NYC, we were looking for ways to raise money. And one of the thoughts was, well, what if we did a charity book? What kind of book should we do? Well, since we're going to be serving kids that are trying to learn how to read and write, why don't we do a book of stories that would possibly intrigue the kid who isn't reading already, who is maybe 9 or 10 years old and who is bored to tears by the book fair in the gymnasium. And so we started, I started looking for stories that were out of print and stories that were favorites of writers that I admired. So I started asking around to some writers that I knew, which stories did you love as a kid and are they still in print? And what ended up happening is every writer I talked to had a favorite story and was very opinionated about it. And gave me, I ended up with a list of probably 100 out of print stories, many of which were very difficult to find. And, but also what happened is they said, occasionally I would get an email back that said, would you want something new? And I realized that a lot of these, of people who are writing adult fiction and novels had dabbled in writing for children or had finished stories on their own And all of them had something in their desk drawer. And so I started asking for those, and that's kind of where a lot of these stories came from.
Among the people who have stories in Noisy Outlaws, Unfriendly Blobs, and some other things, are Nick Hornby, George Saunders, my guest Kelly Link, Jonathan Safran Foer, Neil Gaiman, people whose names that you know who are all donating their stories. Of the people who were new to me, the story that excited me the most was the one by Kelly Link. And it's interesting to me because I went and got her two previous books. Both of them are published by Small Beer Press, and they're called Magic for Beginners and Stranger Things Happen. Now, you'd been writing fantasy stories. I mean, it's safe to say that witches and fairies, they're the protagonists of these very scary invented stories. Had you been writing stories that were meant for children before that?
I've written a couple of stories for anthologies that were going to be for children. I worked in a children's bookstore for about 3 years when I was in grad school and afterwards, and I've always continued to read children's stories and young adult books, and I actually would really like to continue to write for children.
Now, I first saw your work in Conjunctions, and I know that one of the stories in Conjunctions is going to be in this upcoming year's Best American Stories. Have you found that things like Buffy, the things that are, you know, for the in-between audiences, have created an audience for sort of avant-garde fantasy literature?
You know, maybe. I think that there are a couple of things that have happened in the last, 10 years, including Buffy the Vampire Slayer and J.K. Rowling. And the result is that if I'm on a subway, I see people reading J.K. Rowling, and they might be children and they might be adults. And, you know, the same thing is true for some of the television shows as well. And it just seems as if the boundaries are getting a little bit blurred in terms of who is reading what. I don't see people saying quite as much, oh, that's a children's book, I wouldn't want to read it.
Yeah, and one of the things that I kind of love about McSweeney's and the 826s, by the way, is there one in Los Angeles as well?
There is one. There's one in L.A. There's six chapters now open nationwide, Ann Arbor and Seattle and Chicago and New York and San Francisco.
Oh, it's beautiful because what it's doing really is under the initial guise of helping kids with their homework after school, it's also creating writers and readers. And, you know, for better or worse, it's our community, the community of writers and people who love books and love the freshness of writing. It's in our hands. It seems like it's no longer to be necessarily entrusted to publishers or to schools. We have to shake things up and create communities that create the next generation. And that's why, you know, a book like this moves me so much. Now, Jonathan, I think you've been involved with some of the 826s. Have you been down there to Brooklyn?
Oh, yeah, I've been to Brooklyn a number of times, and I've gotten to know Ted through it. And, you know, it's the kind of place you leave feeling really invigorated. It's very, very inspiring. Every time I've been there, there's all sorts of kids, different age groups there, different programs going on. There's a bulletin board as you walk in with what's going to happen in the coming weeks. And there are things that, you know, I would want to. I wish that I were young enough to attend because they look like so much fun. And I think that's, in a way, why they've been so successful is because, you know, you're talking about the responsibility of writers and readers to perpetuate writing and reading. And a mistake that I think has been made is presenting reading, particularly to young people, as a kind of act of self-improvement, you know, a way to become smarter, a kind of mental homework you can do after you've done all of your real homework, whether you're a kid and it's literal or whether you're an adult and it's a job and your various responsibilities, when I think, you know, we both know, everybody on the radio now knows that that's not what reading is about. It's not what writing is about. If there's any self-improvement, it's completely incidental to all of the fun that it can be, to how exhilarating it can be, and to how it can make things sharper and more vivid and make you feel more alive. And 826 is, I think, very, very good about conveying those things about reading.
That was Jonathan Safran Foer. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with editor Ted Thompson, writers Jonathan Safran Foer and Kelly Link, about a new anthology of stories for young adults, Noisy Outlaws, Unfriendly Blobs, and Some Other Things, published by McSweeney's. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ted Thompson, Jonathan Safran Foer, and Kelly Link about Noisy Outlaws, Unfriendly Blobs, and Some Other Things. And one of the things that gave me particular pleasure about Kelly's story, Monster, by my guest Kelly Link, is that these stories are not interested anymore in giving children answers or sending them back into the world as more responsible adults. Those were always, for me, the deadest kinds of children's books. But by the end of your story, Kelly, we've no idea whether this monster is a monster or an invention or a disguise. Is that important to you?
No. You know, I used to read when I was a kid. I would read in bed, and I would read collections of ghost stories by people like Joan Aiken or E. Nesbitt or E.F. Benson. And I just loved being scared. And so what seemed important to me is that somebody reading this story would feel some sympathy for the characters in it and sort of think, well, I've been in a situation like this. And also at the end would have sort of that moment of fright, which is to me sort of a kind of joy, sort of a shock.
Yeah, and it seemed to me that what convinces a reader is that you seem accurate about putting up a tent in the rain and the problems of sleeping one in one, so that once you've done that, everything else seems real enough. Someone who knows how to build the tent does seem to know how to entertain the possibility that snow might fall in the middle of the summer or that a monster might appear in the peripheries of the campfire and know what that monster would say. It's a very probable kind of monster.
Well, thank you. It seemed to me that the worst thing in the world is having to sleep in a wet tent and wet clothes, and that possibly being eaten by a monster would be better than that.
Do you think that... Well, it's also that the boy in the story who talks with the monster has been ascending the ladder of the possibility of friendship. And it's significant that he's talking to the monster while he's wearing a dress that he's been half cajoled, half forced, half tricked into wearing. It seems as if, you know, the first thing for a child to understand is that identity is more fluid than it's ever been thought of in previous generations, and that if you allow for things to be fluid, you might get to have a really revealing interview with a monster, but fluidity seems to be a prerequisite.
I did feel as if, you know, putting on the dress became almost an act of bravery in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that although at first it seemed as if it was going to be sort of a dangerous thing in terms of getting along with the other boys, in fact, they sort of come to respect him for putting it on. And in fact, he's much more interesting to the monster because he looks different.
Yes, and therefore someone who has to be questioned before eaten.
Yes. Well, there are a lot of fairy tales in which, you know, people sort of dress up in outlandish clothing in order to sort of trick a monster or someone dangerous into not dealing with them too harshly.
Now tell me, when children come in to one of the writing centers, have they come in because they've been exposed to this book?
Well, we're starting to see that a little bit. Most of one of the great things about the Dust Jacket, the contest, is that when people finish the story and mail it back to us, I get to actually see a tally of the readership and also see how their writing is. It comes directly to 826 in New York. It comes directly to me, the editor of the book. So that's sort of a great interactive thing. And some of the newest students we've had have come in because they first saw the book and then traced it to our center.
Now, it says on the cover, in fact, that the winning entry will be published in a future book and the author will receive a complete set of A Series of Unfortunate Events signed by Mr. Snicket himself, along with 11 pounds of chocolate, a Venus flytrap, 600 tiny glass bottles, and a large sack of dirt from Winnipeg. Now, of those promises, which will you keep?
All of them.
Really?
Yes. We have all of the prizes in hand.
Uh-huh.
We're ready to distribute to the lucky winner.
Assuming Winnipeg is still around when there's a winner.
We actually have the dirt.
You have the bottles? Separate.
The bottles are in Eli's apartment in San Francisco. We just have to get them to New York somehow.
That's great. But the other implicit thing is, and one of the things that I like so much about what McSweeney's does, I know, for instance, there's another anthology that was published by, I think, Vintage, and it was an anthology of humor pieces that had appeared at one time or another on the website, that the entries are read and to be published in a future book, so that the idea here is being to create a next generation of writers. And what I loved about the projects of this kind so far is that it's not so highfalutin as to rule out the possibility of the inclusion of things that are merely funny or silly. It's not all high literature. It's what I described to Dave Eggers, who, you know, heads McSweeney's, as this great opening of the door, that the gatekeepers are going to be put to sleep while a bunch of people are smuggled over the border into publication, and that you'd wake up and find a new generation of writers free to develop their careers one way or another. When I was talking to a couple of the young guys who started Verse Press, their idea for me was to create a kind of poetry that didn't need translation through the intellect, you know, kind of poetry as fun. Now, I'm of two minds about it, because, you know, there are certain things that I think should need a decoder ring, and I'm not against them. But I love the idea right now that there's a certain pulling down of the very high barrier, so that when the young adults who get this book and complete the contest, they're not, when reading the book, being told that this is going to be impossible to do. It's more like, let's have fun and then see if you might be a writer in the course of having fun.
Mm. Well, there's so much room in the world, you know. Writers in particular, or people within the sort of literary community, are so used to thinking of a single pie that has to be divided up among all people who want to write, and that's not the case at all. You know, there's room for things that are pure fun, and there's room for things that are deadly serious, and for things that are extremely difficult, and for things that are, you know, pleasurable and easy.
I know, Jonathan, that the narrator of the most recent book is young, but did you have any hesitations about presenting him for young adults?
You know, it's a funny thing about the question of whom you're presenting for. You know, it's like an unpainted canvas in an artist's studio is one thing. An unpainted canvas in a museum is something entirely different. We look at it differently. It has different meaning. It has different value. And with literature, I'm not even so sure that I believe in... I think if there's a distinction between literature for adults and literature for children, a lot of it has to do with what we say it is rather than what it actually is. A lot of novels could be repackaged probably and sold as young adult novels. And a lot of young adult novels and probably even children's literature could be repackaged and sold as what we think of as more serious literary fiction. So I really try never to ask the question of whom I'm writing for. Obviously, there's something a little bit awkward in taking part of a novel and putting it in a context where I knew it would be packaged for children. But I think those kinds of questions, when you're actually in the process of writing, are really, not only are they not helpful, they're unhealthy. I've been surprised so many times by when I find out whom it was I actually was writing for. You know, I think the assumption when you begin a piece of writing is always that you're, I think you can't help but assume you're writing for somebody like you. You know, who's going to find this funny? Somebody like me. Who's going to find... I didn't mean you. I meant me. Sorry.
Oh, you mean you. Yeah.
You know, you say, well, who knows? Maybe you're like me. You say, who's going to find this funny? Well, someone like me. Who would be moved by this? Well, only somebody like me. And then a book goes out into the world and you realize people like you don't necessarily respond to it at all. And people in Japan or 80-year-old people or children... do respond to it very strongly. That's what books do. That's the good thing that books do, is they remind us that the things that books appeal to has nothing to do with whether you're a child or you're an adult or whether you're black or white or male or female, or but these very deep things.
Well, a final question also about context, and I want to ask it of all three of you. You know, the book has a dedication, which I'm told was written by a McSweeney's volunteer, Mac Barnett, and I'll just read a part of it. This book is dedicated to General Wilson, a lonely oak tree, who donated his bark, branches, and heartwood to form the pulp that made this paper so you could have a few hours of reading pleasure. No, no, don't feel bad. He was happy to do it for you. Of course, he was very much looking forward to producing acorns next spring, but he's sure the sacrifice was worth your entertainment. And besides, this dedication more than makes up for the loss of his trunk, branches, and leaves. It goes on a bit. But it's very much what I would call the McSweeney's tone. That's both apologetic, a little bit ironic, a little bit plaintive and truthful. I wondered what you guys, variously involved, think of what I'm calling metaphysically the McSweeney's tone. I'll take you first, Ted, because it'll probably be easiest for you.
I've always responded to it immensely. I don't. It is a specific tone, and it's something that, when it's at its best, I think gets at more than one thing at once. It gets at something that's both humorous and sad and a little bit vulnerable for the writer. Mm-hmm. I think at its worst, at times, it's just a little cloying. But, you know, it's I think it's something that it may be generational. It may not be. I haven't really explored it, but it's something that I've always responded to as an early McSweeney's intern all the way until now.
That was Ted Thompson, one of the editors, the main editor of this anthology, Noisy Outlaws, Unfriendly Blobs. Now, Kelly Link, the author of Monster, one of the stories in the book, as well as two collections of fiction, most recently Magic for Beginners, published by Small Beer Press. Kelly?
You know, when I read the dedication, I thought of The Giving Tree,
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a revised version of that, and I like the McSweeney's tone. When I went into the store in California, the Valencia location, and when I walked in, the whole store was a little bit like that. You know, there was a bucket of lard. You could scoop out lard. They had a little scoop that you could buy. And my friend bought some lard, and I bought 2 glass eyeballs. And, you know, that's sort of what the McSweeney style is. I think there was also somebody giving haircuts. And, you know, there just aren't enough stores in the world where you can get lard, eyeballs, and also a haircut.
Okay, and finally, Jonathan Safran Foer.
Well, you know, I think there's a time and place for everything. you know, it's like I was saying, it's not one pie that has to be divided, divvied out. There are times when I'm not so sure that I'm familiar with the voice, but if it's what I think you're describing, there are times when it's just right. It's just what I would want to be around or want to read. And then there are times when I want something completely different. It's like food. You know, literature is so much like food. How can you pick what your favorite meal is? It doesn't make any sense, really. You want pizza sometimes, and you want a fancy French meal maybe some other times. And I think that I'm grateful that the voice, which I don't really think existed before them.
I think so. I think you're right. It's an invention.
Yeah. I'm grateful that it exists.
Well, I think that you can get many different meals, from pizza and gumbo to, you know, a strawberry trifle and an occasional Western omelet, in the collection Noisy Outlaws, Unfriendly Blobs, and some other things that aren't as scary, maybe. There's more to that title, but you'll have to pick up the book to find out the rest of it if you hadn't listened to the beginning of the show. I want to thank you all, editor Ted Thompson, writers Jonathan Safran Foer and Kelly Link. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. Special thanks to recording engineer Leszek Wojciech at the Carnegie Studios in New York City. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Clock.
You've been listening to KCRW's Bookworm. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Good Food, a weekly exploration of culinary trends, tantalizing recipes, and intriguing discoveries in food and drink. Check out the podcast of Good Food at kcrw.com.